Hey folks, for today's episode we're sort of temporarily taking a bit of a break from the gender bender that we've been on over the last little while of this year and getting back to the topic of sex. Today I'm being interviewed by Asaya McKimmy. You may recognise Asaya from an earlier episode on kissing and three episodes on safer sex a while before that. We're talking sort of 6 or 8 years ago, but in this podcast feed you're listening to now. Asaya now has her own podcast up and running, and it's called Our Patients Are Having Sex. And yeah, obviously it's for counsellors, therapists and the like who want to know more about supporting their clients in their sexuality. And yeah, she's interviewing me today on that topic. This may sound very familiar to a course I've spoken about here that I ran recently with Process Work International. Very similar subject material, but yeah, different courses. And you can also still buy access to that course for the next month or two. The link to that is in the show notes. So yeah, today's topic is obviously pitched very much at therapists who want to support their clients around sexuality. It'll also be interesting for you if you are leaning into your sexuality and your kink and fetish interests. And it'll be very interesting and a little bit therapeutic for anyone that's wandered up to a therapist or a counsellor or a psychologist or even like a medical professional and sort of been shamed or looked at strangely because of your interests in sexuality. Some specific topics we cover is stuff like what's ethical and what's not in terms of sexual and kink interests, including a curly little question around does age play lead to pedophilia? We talk a little around how no tends to lead to yes, but not in terms of nagging, persistent, bothering, badgering and harassment and hoping that that leads to yes. More a question of if you respect and get interested and lean into your own no, once you work that stuff out, then yes tends to emerge. Cool little quote in here today. A dungeon full of toys is good, but the ability to use your touch skills is better. And there's a few things, a few bits of personal sharing in here from myself around my experience as a client, which is part of what has motivated me to have this recent sort of swing out towards education for therapists. So yeah, let's get into it.
Rog, welcome to Our Patients Are Having Sex. You were actually one of the first people that I told about this podcast, and here you are, you're on here.
Hi, Asaya. Great to be here. Thanks for running this.
Thank you. And you and I have a bit of a podcasting history together, so it also feels really right to have you as one of my first guests. And you are a guest presenter in the training course that I run teaching what I think is the most fun and interesting module. It's the kink and consensual non-monogamy, ethical non-monogamy module. So I'm really grateful to have you on. The need for that module and also just these conversations in our work and out in the community was really highlighted to me recently when a brilliant therapist referred someone to me for what they thought were pretty concerning sexual behaviors. And when I discussed that with the client, we actually found that they were pretty normal, at least pretty normal for me and my world.
That sounds intriguing. That sounds like fun.
It's pretty interesting. And I think what it really highlights to me, and I'm curious to ask whether you've seen this in your work or not, is just how much we are lacking education around sex and how we can have such a kind of narrow idea of what's normal and what's acceptable.
Sure. Yeah. I think it's really complicated being a therapist in this world, particularly if you are not someone who's lent into these particular genres or nuances of sexuality. They can be really confusing communities and cultures and practices and ways of doing sex from the outside. Some of it's really hard to make sense of. On top of that, we have all of our cultural norms and cultural expectations around like what is allegedly an acceptable amount of sex. And that's not based on science nor psychology. It's based on religion. It's based on governments. It's based on confusing cultural norms that we've gathered over the years. And so it can be really hard as a therapist when someone comes in who has got specialized or nuanced interests, should we say, to work out like, where does that land? And how do you pick a difference mm-hmm. between something that's potentially healthy and something that's potentially dangerous? And if something is, as you say, outside that little narrow bandwidth, which is like who you're allowed to have sex with, how much sex you're allowed to have, don't have more, don't have less, how much you're allowed to enjoy it, don't have more, don't have less, how often, obviously, whether you're allowed to talk about it, don't talk more, don't talk less. As soon as you jump out of that range, you're in confusing territory. And I think the reality is, as therapists, we do sometimes see some, not necessarily horror stories, but some complicated stuff. And it can be hard to pick. Yeah, I don't know. Did you want to say more about the specific example you had in mind? Or
well, the specific example, and this is absolutely no shade to the therapist because I know she is brilliant at what she does. She's a fantastic and really experienced therapist in a range of areas, including working with couples. What she was concerned about were some of the kinkier BDSM interests that one of her clients had and the age that he was first introduced to those, for example, and just how important that was to him in his life. And for me, as I said, when I heard all of that, that all fell into my realm of normal, but I can really understand why someone who doesn't have the same education or hasn't moved in those same sex positive circles as I have would feel concerned and worried about that.
Yeah. I think a really fun little test for the therapist at home to do is to replace the word sex with the word football, because we're talking about two things that rely on skills that we've gotten as a species to get here, i.e. an arousal system is really good for getting the species reproduced, and sports skills, hand-eye coordination, strength, muscle, agility, all of that sort of stuff has been really handy for getting the species to where we're at. So they both have those qualities. They're both things you can do by yourself or with one other person or with a group. They're both things that can be incredibly good for your physical health and your mental health. They can also be really bad. They can cause injury and harm. So they've actually got a lot in common. The difference between the two is one of them is socially sanctioned and one of them is not. So if I came to you as a client and said, I'm worried about my obsession with football. It's like several nights a week for me. I'm like going to a game. I've started playing with my local club. I like think about it a lot. I'm spending a lot of money on sports equipment and oh my God, weekends, just football, football, football. You'd be like, good on you, Tiger. Good job. Go for it. But if I just replaced football with sex, most therapists would be going down a path of, wow, this sounds really dangerous. This sounds like far too much, far too much. This is out of control. This is sex addiction for sure. But I like the model of, is it causing harm to you or the people around you? And if it is causing harm, do you have the capacity to easily rein it in? That for me is my working definition of addiction. And it doesn't matter whether we're talking about work or sex or football or podcasting, speaking for myself there, not you. The definition is the same.
That is a really fantastic exercise and a really fantastic comparison. It's one I often will, when clients will say to me, oh, we shouldn't need help with sex. We should just know what to do. It's natural. I've often compared it to running. Sure, running is natural. You can go out and do it if you want to. But if you want to be really good at it, if you want to avoid injury around it, you learn about it. You get coaching around it. You get support. And so that football analogy fits in really, really well to this.
I love what you're saying about getting an education, getting a learning. I actually think it sits really well. I like your comparison with running. I think I really like the comparison, and I think this is one that therapists will relate to, self-awareness, the process of gaining self-awareness and just having like relationship skills, communication skills and so forth. So as therapists, most of us have gone over that hurdle to go, you know what? I need some more skills in that area. I need to know about psychology and so forth. I've got to get me an education around that because we don't come into this world with set up with the life skills that we need to get through it and to be good at relationships. And when you're a therapist, it's really easy to go, well, of course, I need to get some education and some training. But it's one of those things when you're on the other side of the edge, when you haven't gone over there yet, people just seem to have this pressure that they should be able to do all of those things and be good at those things despite having never got any training. And it's the same with sex. I think sex is a lot easier to get good at than psychology is. I mean, that it doesn't take a lot of books or workshops. Oh, it depends on circumstances. And there's a lot of privilege enmeshed in what I just said. But I think you can make more progress. And most people are very motivated learners in the world of sex. But it's exactly the same. It's unrealistic to expect people to be good at it
out of high school or whatever.
I like this. I would love to hear your thoughts. Obviously, part of why I've started this podcast and part of why I do what I do in educating other therapists and healthcare practitioners is because I see how important sexuality can be to our entire lives and how much that does often get left out of our training, of our consultations. And I do often hear from particularly healthcare practitioners who I know are busy, who are trying to be across so many issues in their partners' lives. I don't have time to ask my patients about sex, or it's probably not relevant, or no, they can go and talk to someone else about that. I'm wondering what you would say to those practitioners who might still be wondering, do I need to know about this? Do I need to ask my patients about this?
Okay, great. Love it. I don't think any therapist needs to, in the same way that there's a lot of areas of specialty, like, I don't know, cancer is one that I've found in the past with my practice. Mm-hmm. I've had clients and just like, you know what? There's going to be some very repeatable patterns here that you're going to go through as a client with cancer. I'm here for everything and I'm here for that. It's just entirely possible that a cancer specialist may be a really good addition to your support mix.
Mm-hmm.
I think sex is like that. I don't think a therapist or a one-to-one practitioner of any variety needs to have any specialist knowledge. I think the only thing they need to be aware of is a little bit of a sense of knowing what we don't know. So it's very easy to slip into accidentally sex shaming clients who express some kind of an interest in something. It's okay to go, huh, that sounds amazing for you. I just need to confess that that's not an area of specialty of mine. If you want to talk about referral spots we could look at or something else, I'm there for you. But I don't know how far I personally can take you down what sounds like a pretty interesting journey. Like, I'd say that's a pretty straightforward, positive way of saying, yes, 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 I can't help you with that, but yes, 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 yes. As opposed to, I've had a few experiences myself. I remember when I was, are we okay for a little bit of personal story share?
Please, yes.
I remember one time when I first ever went to a sexuality workshop and I brought that up in my therapy session, so with my counselor, they were just aghast that such a thing could exist where you could go to essentially a public workshop and talk about sex and engage in simple touch exercises, mm-hmm. even just with, say, like hands. And I saw their face. It was just absolutely shocked for the first quarter of a second before they were able to mute their response. And so I for sure never brought that up again. And then as I was looking for a counselor who could support me more in that area, I remember talking about my interests in kink and so forth. And we had a session. And they did a pretty okay job at the end of saying, look, what you're wanting to work on is interesting. I just need you to know that having looked at that within myself, I've reached the conclusion that it's all sex addiction and hazardous.
Wow. Wow. Wow.
Halfway there. It was some level of awareness, but not surprisingly, I didn't stay with that counsel for that topic. So I think it's okay for them to have reached that conclusion in themselves, but to be aware of that and then positively support your client towards a more positive source of support, I think is key.
Well, thank you for sharing that. My heart kind of breaks for you and for so many of the other clients, because I know they're out there, because people, my clients bring those stories to me as well. They've found the courage to ask a therapist or healthcare practitioner, a doctor, about this sexual challenge or share about this thing that they're interested in and have been shut down around it, have been shamed, have been told that it's wrong, that it might be an addiction in some way. And we know that then they carry that sense of shame or something yes. being wrong with them. And often it means that it can damage their relationships. It means that they're not able to explore what can be a really beautiful and expressive part of themselves. I really liked what you said too about as healthcare practitioners, we don't all have to be experts in this, but we do want to be affirming to our clients and we want to let them know where they can get support around this. If it's not with us, here's where you could go. And For me, this often shows up with healthcare practitioners where patients are not necessarily mentioning their sexual challenges, for example, but we know when you use the example of cancer or if they're having other health issues, pelvic floor issues, hormonal changes, we know that there's a pretty good chance that that is going to be impacting their sex lives and their relationships. And so creating the permission and saying, hey, we know this might be a problem. If it is for you, there's people out there to support you around this so that it is just a part of the conversation. It is part of the space.
Yeah, yeah. I think the numbers, the statistics, it's very hard to find statistics of what number of people or what number of clients have an interest in sexuality generally and kinks, taboos, and fetishes more specifically. Can pretty much promise for all therapists and all counselors, the number is way higher than we think it is. Way, 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 way higher. Most people just keep that to themselves privately because they're used to being shamed.
Right.
Yeah. People like you, yeah. Asaya, and me are on lists. So the sexuality community maintains lists of counselors and therapists who have an open mind or an interest in these areas. And they often have affairs with people like us. So they'll have their main normal counselor and they talk about main normal things. And then for these topics, they'll see someone like us on the side or in a perfect world out in the open where everyone knows about everything. I think when clients move into exploring, when they lean into their sexuality, whether it's just a sense of like, you know what, I think I want more sex in my life, or whether it's what I really want to explore this fetish, they're taking their first steps over their sort of shame edge, but internally they're doing battle with shame. I just need to clear my throat. Where's my little mute button? Internally, they're doing a battle with that shame role. And when they come out to their counselor, who's probably one of the first people they're going to come out to, they're going to be really vulnerable on that front. So if the counselor does anything that could be interpreted as negative or critical or shaming, the client will frame it that way and see it that way because they're projecting their shame onto everyone they see.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think one more final little point. I don't know if this is true, but I feel like because I haven't been around for the entire time that psychology's been around, but I get the impression we're gradually as a sector moving more from advice giving, and this is the way it should be, to being more client-centric and just going the client's process, the client's feedback, is our guide as to what's right and what's wrong. And I think a lot of us that sort of know to be client-centered often make that little mistake when it comes to sexuality. There's a sense that we can't help like letting our values of what's a normal, acceptable amount of sex slip in.
I think that's a really good point. I'm going to ask a controversial question. What is normal when it comes to sex?
What's normal for you, Asaya? I have no opinion. I'm just a person listening to you talk. I don't know. I won't know until we've asked more questions.
Great. I think that's a really great answer. What's normal for you?
Yeah, I can help you take a role of, say, for instance, part of you that is more sexually adventurous and sexually exploring and wants more and wants to be progressive and explore things. And I can help you take a role which is more conservative and cautious and maybe hurt by past experiences and a bit skeptical. I can work with you on them and I'll watch your feedback the whole time. But yeah, the right amount of sex for you is the right amount of sex for you. How about that capitalism, huh? I want to talk with you about a weird way that capitalism is actually kind of functional. It's to do with this podcast. Firstly, I want to stress it's okay for you to just listen to this and not contribute. I say just listen because it's not nothing. By just listening to it, you're engaging with my material, you're probably having chats about it with others, and really, that's all I'm doing this for. I can tell that you are there because I can see you in the total number of downloads, and it means a lot to me. This relationship works for me. It's okay to just listen. At the same time, I know that some of you want to show a more active level of support and are in a position to do so. This is where capitalism comes into it and doesn't actually do a half bad job. I've set up a Patreon page, which, in short, is an easy way for you to contribute. And it's very meaningful to me. I used to be skeptical about paying for podcasts, but eventually I had to ask myself how it differs from paying for books, or for videos, or for workshops, or for therapy, all of which I pay for pretty consistently. And this, my friends, is my version of a book or a workshop or a whatever. So I feel okay about asking for a donation through Patreon if you're in a position to do so and this has been meaningful for you. So the link is in the show notes and also on the Curious Creatures website. If you're not in a position to contribute, please don't feel guilty about listening to this for free. I appreciate you, and I appreciate having you on this ride with me.
What about, so if we've covered what's normal, we've also had these conversations about kink and BDSM and fetishes come up. Firstly, for anyone who doesn't know what some of this means, can you talk us through those terms? What's kink? What's a fetish? How might this play out for someone?
Yeah, great. Love to. Can I be annoying or amazing and just go back and add another point onto that last question of what's the correct term?
Please.
Okay, great. I'm thinking about a person who has had the experience with two different counselors. I'm smushing a couple of stories together a little bit. Someone who was having an amount of sex and a type of sex that would be socially regarded as normal and acceptable. So it was hetero, one partner, an amount of sex, whatever.
Yeah.
And it was horrible. You'd use the word abusive with that. But because it fell within the window of what was deemed to be normal, they were supported and encouraged to continue that practice, those practices.
Wow.
And then at another time, fast forward in their life, they're off having what most people would call a pretty adventurous sex life, up to some pretty interesting things. And it was great for them. Like all of their feedback was congruent about it. They were having a liberating, exploratory, empowered time on their terms, on their consent. And they were discouraged from it by a counselor. That's the tragedy of that whole setup and the question of like what's acceptable, what's normal. And that's why I'm just like, we just have to be client-centered. Yeah.
Yeah. Find out what's going on, how they're feeling about it. You, on the other end of the scale, you reminded me of a story that another colleague shared where she had a couple come to her who were deeply concerned and were seeing her because they wanted to have sex more often. And when she questioned them, they were having sex about once a year and had been for a few years. And when she asked them, well, how much would you like? Where are we trying to get to here? They were like, well, we're actually both happy with this, but we're told that's not normal. We're told that we should be having it more. So that's what we're going for here. And after that first session, she sent them away. She said, you actually don't need to see me anymore here. You do what feels good for you. And I think that is such a good point, whether it's seemingly a high amount, whether it's practices that might be difficult to make sense of, we can check out, does that feel good for a person? Is it consensual? Is it doing anyone, including themselves, harm? And we can support them in that.
Love it. Is it doing anyone harm? I love that. Mm. Yeah. And it reminds me that we often have the sense that there's a Goldilocks zone of the amount of sex you're allowed to be having. And that's a beautiful example, because once a year in a committed couple is regarded by many as too little, too much. That for me is just another form of sex shaming. If that is congruently good for them, if that's all they want, good for you. Happy time being domestic partners, financial partners, parents, whatever it is that you do. Happy times.
Mm. Yeah. Yep.
So you said, what are kinks? What are fetishes? What's BDSM?
Yeah.
Because I was being annoying and awesome, can you ask the question again?
Yes. So for anyone who, you know, who might not have heard of kink or BDSM or fetish before, yeah, what are they and what might someone be doing?
Yeah, great. I'm not going to dodge the question, but it's an incredibly hard one to define. Reason being, what is regarded as, say, let's say normal or mainstream or vanilla, socially accepted, socially sanctioned sex, and what is kink or a fetish or taboo or untoward, that changes from time to time. So, and it changes from geography to geography or culture to culture. So I'm here in Melbourne, Australia. What is acceptable here now is very different to what was 50 years ago, and it's very different to Saudi. just to pick a random example, I'm sorry to my Saudi friends, but there are a lot of practices amongst my community that are quite normal, that are quite illegal in Saudi, as an example. So one of the things I like about the fact that this is so confusing is that it tells us that there is no single cultural reference point as to what normal sex is. Therefore, it's impossible for us to define what's kinky, because as soon as I commit words to it, I'll be out of date or I'll be in the wrong country.
So we really define kinky as what is outside the kind of the norm and the acceptance. And as you make the point, that changes across time, it changes across culture, across locations.
Yes.
Yep.
I think there can be some usefulness in those words and that language, if only just recognize, you know, I really love my last answer and I feel at all strongly about what I'm about to say. There's a usefulness in being able to identify other people within your community, which I think of as a path towards supports. And it's also good to recognize that once you move into that territory, you can't just coast along in default mode. Like if you're playing just within the sphere of vanilla sex, I don't think that people should do that without talking about it and without being intentional and without planning. However, to a degree, you can. And there's not going to be too many surprises there. But partly for consent reasons, partly for safety reasons, and partly just to make things go better, when you're into more specialist areas of sexual expression, I think you need to be more intentional, more communicative, and make sure you've got more trust in place.
Can you tell us about some of those specialist areas, what people might be exploring, and what might show up in a healthcare practitioner's room?
Gotcha. Talking mental health care or physical health care? Not that from one perspective there's a difference, but...
Either.
Yeah, okay. I think in the physical realm, because again, with that analogy of football and sex, if you go to a GP with, say, like a, I don't know, I'm not medically informed, so let's just go with torn hamstring. That sounds like a medical injury that might happen on a sports ball field. If you go to a GP with that, they're more likely to say, oh, good on you, Tiger. We'll get you fixed up. Take it easy for a couple of weeks, but we'll have you on the field in no time. Whereas if you take exactly the same injury, but you got it from a sexual activity, you're more likely to get a raised eyebrow and a concerned look and maybe even a bit of a sense of, oh, you might want to like think about some of your life choices. Just leave it there. So for that reason, people will often create cover stories to explain what's going on, unless it's something more obviously to do with their genitals. So if people have if a client in a physical therapy environment presents with symptoms and the story just sounds odd or confusing, I don't think you need to know the truth in that matter. You need to check things out and do what you need to do to patch them up and get them back out there. But yeah, perhaps it's an opportunity just to make really sure that you're being open and welcoming and positive and supportive.
Again, I really like this comparison to football, because one of the things that comes up in my mind is people talk about their running or like working out and like they feel the burn and it's like no pain, no gain. And that's really, really celebrated in our culture. When we start talking about sex that might involve pain, even intentionally, whether that's through spanking, implements, even kind of accidents, trying a different position. I've fallen off the bed before, trying something new. Whenever it's something like this, we do get a bit concerned and we're like, well, that's not pleasurable. Like, are you sure this is healthy? Are you sure this is okay? And one of the discussions that came up in a group that I was in of professionals, and we were talking about bruises, for example, and I was really candid and I've said I've been involved in sexual practices that have essentially left bruises or some kind of welts on my back. And I can imagine that for anyone seeing that or even someone hearing about that, especially for at the time I was a younger woman, that would be really concerning. But for me, it was really consensual and there was a whole lot of pleasure involved in that. And so I love this idea that if we apply it to football, it's really celebrated. But if it if it's applied to sex, then we start to get worried and we can get a bit judgmental around it.
Yeah. Yeah. I love it. Mm-hmm. And listening to you talk about it reminds me that there's a lot more parallels. And let me see if I can list a few of these. One of the things we get from football and sex is the excitement of doing battle with someone else, of like finding a peer that we can go up against and having a good share fight or a good share fuck. Are we allowed to swear on your podcast?
We're allowed to swear. I think we have to mark all these episodes as explicit anyway. So
okay, great. I'll give you some editing space there just in case. The ability to go up to someone in a fair fight and the ability to go up against someone in a fair and enjoyable sexual exchange. There's also something to be said for the adrenaline of the experience. Both activities produce a certain amount of adrenaline. Both experiences give you something which is sometimes referred to as a runner's high, where if you do hard exercise for a given period of time, you start to trigger the onset of a whole variety of happy chemicals that are incredible mood levelers. And we understand that about, to a degree, we understand that about football and sport, but exactly the same thing is going on in sex. And there's also something to be said for being able to watch your own skill development over time. And that's where it's great to have someone, a sparring partner. Oh, yes, I found neutral language for both activities.
Yeah.
Because there's something amazing about the skill development. You can actually watch yourself getting better and there's something rewarding and pride-inducing about that. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I think the analogies with football go forever.
It's fantastic. I would never have imagined that I would end up talking to you so much about football, Rog.
No. No, nor me. It's definitely not an area of my expertise, but it's a good parallel. Same's all true for foodies, by the way. Food is another thing that we need for our survival. And people go a long way down that path in ways that can be very healthy and supportive and amazing and also dangerous. And it's a great it's a solo act.
Yeah, it is a really, really good point, because you're right. Again, we can get really, really concerned when someone becomes really focused on sex, or when they're using it as a coping strategy, as an escape, and we wouldn't do the same largely with food. We would, it's another one of those kind of socially acceptable things. And when in some ways, and I think I've used this kind of analogy before with colleagues, is yeah, it's the same with alcohol. What is a concerning level of alcohol to someone might be normal and acceptable to someone else. And so we've got to be really mindful around that.
Yeah, nice. Nice. Mm. Yeah, I like it. Yeah.
Hmm. So let's talk about fetishes for a minute, because I know we didn't cover that, and it might be something that comes up for someone. How do you describe what a fetish is?
Ooh. Huh. For transparency, I'm sure there is a well-defined, culturally accepted standard for that. I think of it as an interest in something which is sexual of nature and which is deeper or more nuanced, more compelling, more interesting than just like a passing interested in, I don't know, furniture or whatever else.
Hmm.
And as I understand it, almost anything can become a fetish. So almost anything can find a pathway towards our sexuality or our arousal system.
Mm-hmm.
That's, I guess, what I think the general definition is of it. I would say I don't know to what extent there's links between, say, like childhood experiences or adult experiences and fetishes. I can certainly think of many examples where that is the case, but certainly also many where it's not the case. A lot of people think there's something fundamentally wrong. If you have a fetish, I would say it's definitely has not been my experience. Let me say this in the positive. No, I'm going to say in the negative. People think that if you explore your fetish, if you scratch at it and let it out, then it's going to take over your life and it's just a slippery slope of addiction. That has definitely not been my experience, having watched, I'm not joking, tens of thousands of people open up the door to their sexual yes or their fetishes. It's like anything else. People get really enthused about something for a while, maybe buy some equipment, have some times, and then they're like, oh yeah, doesn't quite do for me what it used to do, or maybe it does.
Mm. So really, a fetish is potentially like a little bit more of an ingrained and a deeper turn on, something a bit more woven into the tapestry, potentially, of someone's sexuality.
Yeah. I think maybe perhaps a fun question on from fetishes. Like, it's not so edgy or so scary if we're talking about, since I keep on looking at items of furniture on my balcony, and I've already used that example, let's just go with that. Let's say I've got a fetish around furniture. Like, okay, good for you. That's quirky, Rog. Love that for you. But it's not immediately, doesn't ring any bells. When we start to get into the area of, say, age play, so particularly when you've got a big and a little, like a daddy or a mummy and a pet or a parent, and like a little girl, little boy, little child or something like that, that's a classic area of fetish which starts to raise eyebrows, because obviously the fear is, does that lend itself to that sort of behavior or that sort of interest expressing itself in the outside world? And again, if you scratch that itch, does it mean that you are on your way to pedophilic thoughts or activities? You can also have interesting examples around race play and a bunch of other ones, but let's just stay with age play. I've been looking for evidence of this for a long time. I've yet to find any evidence that people that play with that can't draw the distinction of what they want to have happen in their private life and what they want to have happen in the outside world. Likewise, consensual non-consent, so where within a caring, loving, not just it doesn't have to be loving, but within a trusting relationship, you agree that you're going to be doing some stuff which might from the outside look non-consensual. Like, no, stop that. I don't want that. Stop that. No, please, no. None of which is my safe word.
Yep.
People who enjoy playing either side of that power exchange don't want it in the real world. There's incredible clarity there. And I've never seen any research to support the idea that scratching one means that that leaks out into the rest of your life. If one begins the journey with pedophilic intentions, they're still going to be there. But yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I can't 100%, sorry to interrupt, I can't 100% definitively say that one will never lead to the other, but gee, for the number of people that play with that particular fetish and the amount of research that's been done on it, I've yet to see the research that shows that one leads to the other.
And I certainly haven't seen that either. And I think when I think of like my understanding around kinks and fetishes is that it's like kinks are like something that turns us on, that we like to explore. It's like a fun to have. A fetish is a little bit more of a need. It's a little bit deeply ingrained. And then we can go further on that scale to what would be like a paraphilia or a sexual orientation, which is where that is what kind of has always turned you on. And there's very little outside of that. It's not necessarily something that developed, and my understanding of some of those more, and I will say, dangerous sexual behaviors, and I am talking about pedophilia in there, that they are really different to people who are exploring kink or their fetishes, where that is more of a choice. It's something that's developed, and they're doing that consciously. They're doing that with boundaries, they're doing it with consent, and they're doing it with communication, knowing that everyone is safe in that environment and everyone is consenting.
Yes, yes. And I would say, since we're here in the context of therapy and psychology, there can often be a lot of therapeutic usefulness in people exploring those particular roles, or you might even say those particular archetypes if you've gone more down the Jungian path of your education, by which I mean these roles are out there in the cultural field. Issues of, say, non-consent are a part of almost all of our lives. I would say all of our lives. And I know of many people who, with varying degrees of intentionality, play out roles relating to those themes in a very therapeutic way. So in the same way we do role play work within, say, Gestalt, my own process-oriented therapy, and a lot of other modalities, in the same way that we things in narrative therapy, where we set up a situation and then create a new ending for the story as part of our therapy, in the same way we do a lot of that stuff in psychodrama, even, sorry, going back more to the 70s now. Within the fetish community, within the kink community, I see people doing very similar things of setting up defined, safe spaces for them to run experiments and do explorations. But the crucial difference is that things are on their terms and they have safe words in place. And also debriefing afterwards.
Yeah, it's so fascinating to me. What you touched on is something that I, and especially lately, I've been exploring this a little bit more with my with my clients is something called core erotic theme. And this, I think, was coined, this phrase was coined by a sexologist called Jack Moran.
Yes, I think
we're going back 20 years. Yeah. And it really looks at what are those deeper erotic themes that we have. And what I have found so fascinating about this is not just how that plays out in my sex life. And so, and for transparency, mine is around power and control, but then also how that plays out and how that interconnects with life. And so I know a lot of people who are really in control in their life and then like to be in a space in the bedroom or wherever else they might be engaging in this sexual erotic play where they are absolutely not in control because they don't get to experience that in their life. And I think there's that really interesting interplay with our psyche. And you're right, we can explore some of these different themes in really healthy ways in the bedroom. It doesn't always mean we want them to play out in real life. And it doesn't always mean that we want them to be like non-consensual or for us really to have no power, for example, but we do want to explore that in different ways.
Yeah, great. Yeah, I love it. I think the point you make around power exchange is really true in that people that are in responsible positions all day where they're making a lot of decisions, so whether they're running a family or running a business or running a country or whatever else, they get to their evening time and they just want to be told what to do for an hour. And I think that's very just and fair. And you also get the opposite. So people who maybe don't have such a good relationship with their own power for whatever reason, underemployed, whatever, not in relationship, who knows? Sometimes it can be amazing and great therapy to have an opportunity to be in the other role. On the point of, I think you're right that Jack Moran was the originator of that work. I got a thought on the idea of the core erotic theme, and I don't know. This is just a fun idea to play with. I don't at all know whether this is fact. I don't know whether if anything I've said today is fact, but this definitely is more in the interests of something I find interesting. I don't know to what extent those things are hardwired within us forever, and to what extent they're circumstantial for certain periods of our life. And once we have a dalliance with a particular erotic theme, whether we sometimes work it through to a something like a conclusion and then move on from there. Because I know speaking for myself, I've had things that have been, you'd absolutely call them a fetish and something I've been just hugely focused around in my sex life for periods of time. And they felt like they would be forever materials and they've turned out not to be.
Interesting.
And I don't spot a through theme there. So in the same way that, say, with like a Myers-Briggs style of test, there's a whole debate there as to whether you're that type of person forever or whether you're that type of person in the context of who you're with and what's been going on in your life lately. I don't pretend to know the answers to these things, although I lean more towards a flexible model. But either way, it doesn't matter. You could say my core erotic theme at the moment is blah, 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 blah.
Right. I like that approach. I think one of the kind of analogies that I will use sometimes with clients is that for me, sex is like a range of ice cream flavors. And there are so many different versions of what can be amazing and what can be enjoyed. And some people are drawn to one flavor more of the time at the exclusion of others. And other people are more willing to try different things. And again, as long as it's consensual, as long as it's safe for me, go out and enjoy and explore all of those different flavors or potentially just give them a try and decide whether or not you actually do like it.
Yeah, I love it. And to a degree, it's context dependent on what's available. Like if I'm in a little small supermarket in a country town, I'll only have a couple of flavors to choose from there, but I'm going to love it. But if I'm at some like gourmet bourgeois place in the city and it's like 65 flavors, then perhaps we'll try something a little bit more weird. So what I mean by that is it depends on the partner or partners you're with.
Yeah, that makes sense. If someone was, and I know this is a question that a lot of my clients bring is, okay, sex is okay, but it's a bit routine. Feels like we do the same thing every time, we get turned on in the same way, and then it's over in the same amount of time. If someone did want to start changing that up, start exploring, start bringing in some different ideas, where do you recommend that they start with that?
Oof. I think it's perhaps I don't have any like set formula that works in all cases. And by all cases, I do mean almost all cases, because I think that almost every long-term couple will at some stage have a situation something like what you've just described. So first thing is that's the most normal thing in the world. Well done. Good job. Second thing, like maybe like a little health check on the relationship and the sex life that's there. Because if there's conflict or unresolved things or disrespect in the relationship, that's going to come out in sex. Or if there's things that are in the sex life that are not going so great. So classic patterns, maybe one person does most of the offers. They've been rejected enough times. The offers get less and less interesting over time. Or maybe something's not quite right about touch. So maybe that's why creativity and flow isn't there by itself. So a little bit of a health check on those things. Then I'd be like, okay, great. Well, what do you know about your interests? And then who's got the motivation to do some research about that, find out how to do it, and what would be an appropriate baby step? I should use different language because we were talking about pedophilia before. What would be a good, appropriate, safe, small step to take towards that type of play? So if someone suddenly out of the blue has an interest in, I'm just going to stay with furniture as my theme for today. Someone's discovered that they really want to do furniture play with their partner that's sexualized somehow, however that works, then maybe a small introductory safe step towards that is just like having some sex with a bit of furniture in the room. I'm being a bit facetious. And then maybe you get the furniture involved a little bit more, and then maybe there's like more specialized types of play. I really hope this analogy is transferring, but just like introduce gradually and use education. Yeah. I'm a huge fan of games. And I know when I think that I came up with this game, but I also know for a fact that many sex educators came up with it before me. But this is such a go-to for me, which is something like either the 2-minute game or the 3-minute game or the 1-minute game or whatever. And it's the same deal. One of us goes first. We take it in turns to ask for what we want in pretty simple terms. If the other person is into that, they say, yeah, great, let's do it. You start the timer for 2 minutes. You do that activity for 2 minutes. And then straight away, it's the next person's turn. And take away all pressure for that to look anything like sex. It can just be a couple of quirky people hanging out, having fun, presumably involving touch, but doesn't have to. Presumably taking clothes off, but doesn't have to. And God knows there's no pressure expectation around pleasure or orgasms or whatever. And the reason I like that game, it takes a few rounds to get the groove, but the reason I like it is it trains people to get really quick at just asking for whatever they want in an environment where they're free to do so. They're not going to get shamed for it. Everyone's taking equal turns of who's in the middle, who's the center of attention and who's not. So one of the things that I like that comes out of that is that you learn about each other's interests. And even without introducing kinks, fetishes, items of furniture, since that's my theme, even without introducing that, couples often learn new things about what touch they're interested in. And sometimes that can be a little bit surprising. It's like, oh, I didn't know you liked that. Or I thought you really liked it when I did that thing. So, yeah.
I really like your answer. Izzy had asked something similar a lot, and I feel like people are often expecting me to mention toys or handcuffs or whips or something of that nature. And for me, I tend to come back to more of what I would call some of the fundamentals. Like, firstly, is a couple connected? Are they able to communicate about sex without it turning into an argument, without lots of really unhelpful emotion around it? And as you've said, are there just different ways that they could be touching each other? And that needs to have that safety and trust and communication often to be able to discover that. But we often don't need to introduce a whole lot of extra things to the bedroom or even do things that we might consider sexy or kinky, to change things up. It can just be understanding, exploring. And I also love the concept of games. I have a few different versions of something like the 3-minute game that I get couples to do. And they will often discover things about each other that they had no idea about just because they had never been given permission to share about it or explore. And I think that is one of the things that I'm often saying to clients is you can get it wrong. Sex doesn't have to be perfect all the time. This is just about exploring and discovering what you like. Like, this is like an adventure, a safe adventure. that you're in together and take away that pressure of what it's going to be or how it's going to end or all of the things that you think it should involve.
I love what you're saying about taking off the pressure, creating like a little open space and a spot where there's no such thing as this, there's not so much thing as no, but where you're not going to get shamed for making odd, quirky little suggestions or something like that. That there is the key from which everything else springs. I think a lot of this is about when people come wanting to work on their sex, bad choice of language, when people present wanting to work on their sex life, they're often wanting to lean towards their yeses or their accelerators. And I think most of the work is in looking into the no and looking into their brake pedals. And once you sort out the no, once you sort out what they don't like about sex, like, oh, I don't feel like I can tell you to stop touching me like that. Or, oh, I feel like I always like wind up rushing too quickly and then I feel guilty afterward. Once you work on all of the reasons for the no, that couple that couldn't get it together before suddenly find all this space in their calendar. And you know what? They work out how to take their clothes off just like that. So it's often a case as therapists of being skillful in working out what the no is. So we don't need to know anything about the yeses. We don't need to know how to buy handcuffs and chains and whatever else. In fact, I'm gonna coin a phrase here and now for you, Saya. A dungeon full of sex toys is good. Using your brain and your touch is better.
I like it.
I was going to say, yeah, like using your brain and your fingers, but like not all of us have fingers, so touch. But yeah, your brain and your capacity to give and receive touch.
I love it. Rog, similarly, for any therapist or healthcare practitioner who has been listening and has been thinking, maybe I was the practitioner who has unintentionally shamed one of my clients or shut them down when they were about to ask about this, or just in some way not always been that safe space to have patients be able to ask questions about sex and relationships and how it might be connected to whatever else is going on. Where do you recommend that they start within themselves in cultivating that, perhaps being a little bit more sex positive in the work they're doing without it necessarily going too far or making someone uncomfortable or having to learn a whole lot of extra kind of skills and knowledge?
Yeah, and it is a fine line. If at any stage during this conversation it's come across like I'm saying like therapists should be into sex or supportive of sex or even want to have a space where clients can have those conversations, that's not what I mean. I think like the consent and the comfort of the therapist has to be in there. So I'm in full support of therapists who are just like, for whatever reason, they want to go there. Like, it just feels wrong to me to talk about sex in this level of detail with clients. It feels wrong to invite this into the professional dynamic of I need to stay removed and detached and not get confusing and blurred with the relationships. So I'm in full respect of that. And every therapist will have to draw that line and have that boundary in place at a spot that feels right for them. However, yeah, when you ask that question, what comes to mind for me is I know more. So I've been a sort of a part-time counselor for 10 years and various other forms of therapies, if I can get away with that ambiguity, for probably 15 years. And I know that every time I've put myself under a pressure, like I need to know everything or I need to be across everything, I've always found that to be the least sustainable way for me to operate. And also I'm less useful to people. So I think there's something to be said for transparency around the topic. Just, again, the topic of cancer in therapy might be an easier one where we would feel less loaded. But just to be, if someone brings up sexuality or has historically and you want to circle back and just mention it again, just to be transparent around, I'm supportive of your research or leaning towards that part of your life. And I'm just really aware that that's not an area I specialize in, and it, to a degree, probably is a bit of a specialized area. So, let me know if I can find you some referral points if you want. Yeah.
I love that. I really appreciate, Rog, your acceptance, your non-judgment and your non-shaming of anyone who is in this space, because you're right. It's absolutely okay for us as therapists or healthcare practitioners to not feel comfortable around this. I think we can know our own boundaries, and I think it's also important that we recognize how that might impact clients at times. And so we've got other steps and other ways that we can support them if it's not us.
Yes. And to a degree, this is a cultural awareness point. So if I've had, say, a religious background, which is very specific around what sex is allowed to look like, that's just a really good thing to be aware of. It doesn't mean I need to agree with or be comfortable with other things, but I don't have to deal with them myself, so long as I don't shame people who are outside my category of normal. Likewise, if I have had difficult, challenging, traumatic or abusive experiences in relation to sexuality myself, I don't have to sit in my own damned counselling room and listen to detailed stories of something that might be eerily close to home.
Absolutely.
I don't know if I managed to do this in life, but I try to work to the assumption that everyone's perfect as they are. So we've been talking about it as it applies to clients. If a client wants no sex or a million kinds of sex, that's perfect. Let's just work on that. But likewise, therapists are perfect as they are. Whatever level of engagement they want with this topic is perfect.
I love this. Thank you so much, Rog. Thank you for everything that you've brought to this conversation. As I said at the beginning, the module where you teach, and they're normally, the classes tend to be 2 hours because there is often so much discussion from the participants. I have loved seeing the students engage and be able to share your knowledge and skills and experience around this. It is the module that I tend to look forward to in the course. So thank you for that. Thank you for your generosity for being on here. If anyone is wanting to engage with more of your work and what you do and learn from you, because I know you have such a range of skills in this area, where can they do that right now?
I can be found at curiouscreatures.biz, B-I-Z.
Excellent.
Always a pleasure engaging with you about this material. Thank you so much, Isaiah.
Thanks so much, Rod.
How about that capitalism, huh? I want to talk with you about a weird way that capitalism is actually kind of functional. It's to do with this podcast. Firstly, I want to stress it's okay for you to just listen to this and not contribute. I say just listen because it's not nothing. By just listening to it, you're engaging with my material, you're probably having chats about it with others, and really, that's all I'm doing this for. I can tell that you are there because I can see you in the total number of downloads, and it means a lot to me. This relationship works for me. It's okay to just listen. At the same time, I know that some of you want to show a more active level of support and are in a position to do so. This is where capitalism comes into it and doesn't actually do a half bad job. I've set up a Patreon page, which, in short, is an easy way for you to contribute. And it's very meaningful to me. I used to be skeptical about paying for podcasts, but eventually I had to ask myself how it differs from paying for books, or for videos, or for workshops, or for therapy, all of which I pay for pretty consistently. And this, my friends, is my version of a book, or a workshop, or a whatever. So I feel okay about asking for a donation through Patreon, if you're in a position to do so, and this has been meaningful for you. So the link is in the show notes and also on the Curious Creatures website. If you're not in a position to contribute, please don't feel guilty about listening to this for free. I appreciate you, and I appreciate having you on this ride with me.